Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 29th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Richard Robin. Today's session number is ROR 2001-6, and it's titled Genetic Engineering: Should We Fear Frankenfood? Let's listen in.
I haven't got much to go on.
I may be in somewhat the same space you are in that I am aware of genetic engineering that's been done for hundreds of years with cross-pollination, but I am concerned about some of the newer chemical alterations and developments, such as the soybean that is not susceptible to damage from Roundup when it's used, and that type of engineering. What are the risks that we're faced when we start developing plants like that?
Okay. Yeah, I'm concerned with that same thing too. Kind of the unintended consequences of what seems like a good idea. Can't some of these plants that are Roundup, what do they call them?
Roundup ready
plants.
Yeah.
Cross with weeds or something, and you might just end up having just like when you have resistance to antibiotics that build up, and then this thing worked great.
Yeah. Now, yes, they both started.
See those same problems there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the risks are greater.
You missed the first 2 minutes of both of them, probably.
Okay.
And the risk, like in the corn,
these probably should be
butterflies. You're trying to kill off one pest.
When I had them up there earlier, it
unwittingly, you end up killing off other good organisms.
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback on
that. So I guess that all goes under that part of unintended consequences.
Could be. I can use the tape player in there. Well, can't record him, just play.
But what are the other implications?
Yeah.
I worry about the power that companies, patent holders, might have over food sources, like Monsanto, that seems to wield tremendous power.
Am I putting a word in your mouth by using the term monopoly?
No, that sounds good.
Okay.
Isn't there some kind of a lawsuit going on now with some particular kind of yellow beans that I don't know what Monsanto says that they developed, but these farmers down in Mexico said, hey, we've been doing these yellow beans Mexico or some part of California for a long time.
Yeah.
And you can't say we can't plant our beans or anything.
Right. Well, apparently there was a farmer who ended up with Roundup Ready crops without having bought the seed. And he said that he didn't steal it, that they just showed up on his farm, and who are they to tell him that he can't raise them?
He was just kind of, it's another case, but that was the case in Saskatchewan, where we're from. Did it make big news?
Yeah, that's the one that I've heard about, but there could be others that I don't know about.
Natural mutation?
Well, it's very unlikely.
What are you
very
doing?
Unlikely that there was any sort of natural mutation.
And which college are you in?
Idaho State.
But, it's something that the plaintiffs would have to prove in court.
I was in the East for a while.
The attempt to support overpopulation.
Okay.
In the loss of the smaller family.
Mm-hmm.
could we say promotes non-sustainable farming? Would that capture what you're thinking, or?
Yeah.
Say overpopulation.
And I kind of like.
Well, okay, we all know what we're talking about here. Lots of.
You know, with me looking for a job, I've been there long enough, and I've seen people stay too long. And I don't want to do that.
Popular trees that Jeanette is working on, are those for manufacturing paper?
Well, he does pure science.
Stay too long, and all people remember are the last.
Professor Concern is a research associate professor, and he gets a lot of funding from the National Science Foundation. He also gets some funding from the pulp and paper industry, but what he was doing was basic genetic research, and they may find applications for it, but that's not his.
There'd be a high burnout rate in that field.
It is possible that from his research could come applications for industrial fiber production.
That's what
a lot of the companies would use them for. His objectives are just to learn more about plant genetics. So they happen to overlap. Their interests and his interests overlap, but the reason he's doing it on poplars is because that's where the funding is. He wants to do basic genetic research, and he would use any organism he can get funding to study.
Some of the poplars are being used for silage.
Another year, you can really.
The market has sort of disappeared for paper pulp in the Northwest, and a lot of people are using the younger stands of the hybrid poplar for silage.
I didn't know that.
I guess I just sort of have a concern with this happening sort of in the greater picture of all the genetic engineering stuff that's going on. What does it mean for us as humans to be taking on this kind of power, thinking that we have this kind of power? How does that affect us and our relationship with nature and our relationship with the world?
The other day, though, I said, your honeymoon's about
to be like too many things. I don't know much about it, but kind of a lack of humility. What makes us become this sort of.
Can I sum that up in this Greek word?
Yes.
What is hubris?
Hubris is the word, and hubris was the. The great cynic mortals in attempting to become godlike, in presuming to become godlike. Something like Lucifer in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Well, that's a good list. I think that covers an awful lot of the most serious concerns. Really, it comes down to where are we going? Do we have any idea where we're headed with this and what might happen as a consequence? I've got a couple of literary selections which I always resort to. The first is by Robert Creeley. It's called I Know a Man. As I said to my friend, because I'm always talking, John, I said, which was not the name, the darkness surrounds us. What can we do against it? Or else, shall we? And why not buy a goddamn big car? Drive, he said. For Christ's sake, look out where you're going.
They have a park there.
And then on the same theme, by Gary Snyder, Pay for the Horses.
A lot of minivans, there's always minivans, and
He had driven half the night from far down San Joaquin through Mariposa, up the dangerous mountain roads, and pulled in at 8 a.m. with his big truckload of hay behind the barn. With winch and ropes and hooks, we stacked the bales up clean to splintery redwood rafters, high in the dark, flecks of alfalfa whirling through shingle cracks of light, itch of hay dust in the sweaty shirt and shoes. At lunchtime, under black oak, out in the hot corral, the old mare nosing lunch pails, grasshoppers crackling in weeds.
State and county.
I'm 68, he said. I first bucked hay when I was 17. I thought that day I started, I sure would hate to do this all my life. And damn it, that's just what I've gone and done. So, it's about setting out on a course that we really don't intend. Well, let me tell you a little bit about what transgenic engineering is all about. Maybe I should start with genetics, basically. I think everybody is aware that DNA is what genes are made of.
I think it's something I could like to do.
Genes are on chromosomes, and chromosomes are in the
only be
egg and sperm cells
right now, just the
that make us what we are.
So, I don't really want to. I like where I'm at. No.
We have been artificially selecting for certain traits of animal and plant species for as long as humans have had any form of agriculture, which is at least 10,000 years. And if you account for some of the more basic forms of agriculture, it could go back quite a bit longer than that. But certainly we had domesticated animals, and we had domesticated crops, which were clearly different from anything that grows in the wild. By 10,000 years ago, by the time the city of Jericho was built. There was no such thing as cities before there was agriculture. Because agriculture gave us the ability to have an economic surplus. And from that economic surplus came the leisure time to develop a culture and civilization. Now, there are even some people who say that was our fall, that just as Adam and Eve tasted of the tree of knowledge, in developing agriculture, we separated ourselves from nature and became a creature apart from the rest of creation. And some people are advocating the Paleolithic diet now, in which you eat no grains other than wild grains, which means you eat an awful lot of them. And you eat wild game and subsist on that, and whatever fruits you can find off native trees and shrubs. And that would be more in consonance with what we are best adapted to, and that would give us better health and so forth. Well, of course, Paleolithic humans had much shorter lifespans than our own. As one famous British philosopher once said, life was nasty, brutish, and short. But there are some people who believe that we should even shut the door on the knowledge we've accumulated up to the threshold of genetic engineering. Being a scientist, of course, that's inimical to me. I promote the expansion of knowledge. I think knowledge is a good thing. I think its application can be misused and has been. And you can almost certainly expect that it will be, and it's up to people of good conscience and people who are well-informed and who think deeply to ensure that the expansion of our knowledge serves noble ends and beneficial purposes
on all the history of
rather than
I read that before it came out
bad ones.
Yeah.
This question of genetic engineering goes all the way back to the time of Jacob. Now, I think Jacob wanted to get married, if I'm not mistaken. The deal was
quite a deal.
No, actually.
I mean, it could have just all fallen in and been.
No, Jacob made a deal with Laban. Jacob was married. Laban was his father-in-law, and Jacob was famous for animal husbandry. And in order to get Jacob to help him with his flocks, Laban agreed to let him keep all the speckled and streaked goats and sheep that were born in the flocks that he tended. Well, Jacob was no fool, so he got out his genetic engineering stick. Then this is what it says. Here's Laban. "What shall I give you?" Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything if you will do this for me. I will again feed your flock and keep it. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from it every speckled and spotted sheep and every black lamb, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and such shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later when you come to look into my wages with you. Every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs, if found with me, shall be counted stolen." Laban said, "Good, let it be as you have said." But that day, Laban removed the male goats that were striped and spotted, and all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white on it, and every lamb that was black, and put them in charge of his sons. And he set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob was pasturing the rest of Laban's flock. Then Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane and peeled white streaks in them, exposing the white of the rods. He set the rods that he had peeled in front of the flocks in the troughs, that is, the watering places where the flocks came to drink. And since they bred when they came to drink, the flocks bred in front of the rods. And so the flocks produced young that were striped, speckled, and spotted. Jacob separated the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the striped and the completely black animals in the flock of Laban. And he put his own droves apart and did not put them with Laban's flock. Whenever the stronger of the flock were breeding, Jacob laid the rods in the troughs before the eyes of the flock that they might breed among the rods. And so forth. So, Jacob put these striped sticks in front of the goats and sheep, and consequently was able to produce the spotted and speckled and striped progeny. Of course, we understand that the mechanism is not exactly as it's described, which makes it a good thing that we don't consider this the absolute literal truth. I'm going to show you, I'd just like you to pass these around. These are examples of beings, and almost all of them, you'll note, are in a single species. They're varieties of beings that have been selected by human beings for their genetic characteristics, not through any genetic engineering. But there's really an amazing diversity. These are all legumes. They're all in the pea or bean family. Some of them are in different genera, chickpeas, cowpeas, or black-eyed peas, lima beans, lentils. They may be in different genera, but most of them are actually just a plain, old, ordinary, common bean native to North America. The one with the green labels are from the desert southwest, except for the lentils, which come from Asia, but all the beans in there are heirloom species from the desert southwest. So this is an example of biodiversity that we ourselves have selected for, and we have actually increased the diversity of this particular species of bean to suit our own purposes.
wouldn't that fly in the face of all those who have now protested and want to eat only the natural things that have been unchanged? I mean, wouldn't beans like this say you can't eat beans?
Well, yeah, the people who think that we should return to the Paleolithic hunter-gatherer mode of living would. I will say that as far as I know, this is an extreme minority. We probably aren't going to get a big debate going about that. Am I right? Okay. The other questions that we should address, though, the basic genetic mechanisms. We have in our cells a double set of chromosomes. The complements, we get half from one parent and half from the other. And when in our gonads we form the germ cells, the reproductive cells, the egg and sperm, they split into a half set in a process called meiosis. That's different from mitosis, which is just a cell dividing with a complete complement of chromosomes. In meiosis, you produce either egg cells or sperm cells. And actually, women are born already with their egg cells ready to go. With men, they're always producing new sperm cells. But when these egg and sperm unite, the genetics are completely mixed. And every sperm cell, when it undergoes this process of meiosis, could end up with a different complement of genes. That is, each sperm cell could be genetically unique. When they divide up, they don't divide up the same way all the time. And that's why your brothers and sisters don't look exactly like you do, unless they're identical twins, in which case they came from a fertilized egg that then divided into two and developed as separate embryos. But that's why when we breed crops the old-fashioned way, we shuffle the deck completely every time. And so we can never be sure what we're going to get unless we breed things that are genetically identical with one another. In other words, breed identical twins, and you're going to get more of the same. Same thing comes from cloning. Plants are easily cloned. You can put a stick in the ground, and it will sprout and produce a new shrub or tree. And botanists have been able to use tissue culture. Just take a little bit of stem tissue and grow it in a lab and put the right plant hormones in it, and it will sprout leaves and roots and eventually grow into a new plant. And that's very common in the nursery trade.
Should you bring a check?
But those are all more or less traditional methods that nobody is in great fear of. Now, as a result of that process, we have developed industrial agriculture without resorting to the what I will call genetic engineering,
yeah, and they'll be up there,
as distinct from old-fashioned breeding of plants. Genetic engineering involves the introduction of a gene through non-traditional means. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean cross species lines.
We'll get them done today.
You could take one corn species or one corn plant here and one corn plant there and select a particular gene that you've mapped that you know is going to produce a particular trait and insert it into the other corn plant. That saves you having to reshuffle the deck and not knowing what you're going to get. You could go from corn to corn. And if you've got one corn you know is resistant, say, to the corn borer for some reason, you could take that corn borer resistance gene and stick it in the other corn plant through genetic engineering. It's not going to give you something that could not happen in nature. It's just going to ensure that the trait that you really want is going to come through in the very next generation. So it's much more efficient. And also, if you know that the corn that you're taking the gene from is safe for human consumption and doesn't have anything weird about it. It's not producing any proteins that some people might be allergic to. By selecting that single gene and putting it into the new corn, you know that you're only changing one thing. So, what are genes? Anyhow, the DNA is a series of... Anybody see the movie Gattaca? Okay, well, Gattaca is for the GATC. Those are the four basic...
News of the day. Do you get...
They're called bases. And
many times?
They make up the DNA molecule. That plus a phosphate molecule. But they are strung together in a long double helix. I'm sure you've all seen this. And each line on this double helix represents either a G, an A, a T, or a C. And that is what codes for everything. It's just those four different bases and what order they're in that determines ultimately what proteins are going to be produced by the various genes. The DNA is in the nucleus of the cell. And the DNA, a gene on this DNA, consists of two parts. There's a regulator, and then there's the part that codes for a protein. This regulator determines when the gene is on or off, and how many copies of the protein it's going to make under what conditions. So this is sometimes called a promoter, but it's got a start and a stop. And this part is what goes out of the nucleus and goes to the protein factory in the cell. And there's a transcription process. But basically what happens when this little snippet comes out of the nucleus and goes to this protein factory, ultimately what you end up with is a protein, a series of amino acids. You know, there are essential amino acids that we have to consume in our food, and then there are other amino acids that our bodies can produce. And this is how they produce them. So basically, a gene codes for protein. Other things in our bodies are produced by other mechanisms, but it's the proteins, and that includes all kinds of things, steroids, hormones, that genes are responsible for. Now, some people are allergic to some proteins. Peanuts produce a protein that can kill people.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And they're very careful about the food they consume because of that. And so you have to be careful when you're crossing things that you don't end up with a protein like that. So what will it do to our bodies? It's a very good question. There actually was an example of... methionine is one of those essential amino acids. And it's produced in abundance by Brazil nuts. The Pioneer Hydrate Seed Corporation produced a hybrid crop that included... the methionine gene from Brazil nuts. Well, some people are violently allergic to the protein produced by that gene, and fortunately they stopped before they went any further with it, and the folks who support this type of genetic engineering say, well, that's a good example of how things are self-policing. But it does raise some concern that they went forward any distance at all with that idea, because it was well known that that the Brazil nuts were highly allergenic. Yeah.
So that was a project in which they were taking a gene from Brazil nuts and putting it into a different...
That's right. It was a trans species genetic engineering.
And let me see if I can...
So why do they even do that project, knowing that a lot of people are persons who would be allergic to protein?
Well, I have to say that they weren't very clever. I don't know. I don't know what possessed them. Somewhere along the line, somebody just didn't get clued in. What was it? Yeah, it was methionine. They were going to provide this in a soybean, a transgenic soybean.
But you'll, I imagine
to,
you will...
To help diets in West Africa that are severely deficient in methionine. So it was with all good intentions to improve the nutrition of folks in West Africa that weren't getting methionine in their diets. But somewhere along the line, they were a little late in getting word that was well known in other sectors that the Brazil nut could induce severe reactions. Now, it's not to say that traditionally bred crops could not also introduce new proteins from... You know, one thing that's often done is that wild-type plants are sought out because of their particular resistance. Corn, for example, looks nothing like the corn that, from which it was bred. In Mexico, you can find a plant called teosinte. It was the precursor of corn. That's an N. Teosinte is a little thing, and it produces an ear that is maybe the size of a walnut. That would be the actual size of the ear of corn. And it's fairly tough and dry and not all that nutritious. But through thousands of years of traditional artificial selection, we've got this big, fat, juicy ear that, of course, isn't going to go anywhere from where it falls. It's not... You never see corn growing in an abandoned field, maybe an abandoned agricultural field for a very short time, but it dies out. It can't compete in the big, tough world in the wild. It's a pampered lapdog of a species, and sometimes they go and seek out different strains of teosinte, for example, to cross with that. Well, that might introduce a protein that wasn't in there before, and that too could be dangerous to some folks. Any time a new crop, a new breed of crop is introduced, it has to be vetted through the U.S. Department of Agriculture in this country. And with these transgenic organisms, the Environmental Protection Agency also has a role because they're concerned about introducing toxicity. And that's what's been done with BT corn, which takes me to another issue. This BT corn contains a substance, a protein that is toxic to lepidopterans, moths and butterflies. Bacillus thuringiensis is a natural soil bacterium. Some people spell it with an I and some without at the end, but it came from Thuringia, wherever that is. And Bacillus thuringiensis produces a protein that will break down the guts of moths and butterflies, of their larvae, the caterpillars, including the corn borer. Well, what corn farmers have been doing is spraying pesticides on their crops in order to kill the corn borer. Pesticides that are not all that selective.
Nice.
They kill not only moths and butterflies, but lots of other insects.
Awesome.
And Bacillus thuringiensis is used by organic farmers, and they will dust that on their crops because it doesn't use any of these fluorinated or chlorinated hydrocarbons, the neurotoxins, that poison the nerves of moths and butterflies. And other species, other critters. The Bacillus thuringiensis is more selective. it just gets the moths and butterflies. And if you don't have a lot of crops that attract them, if you've got just specific larvae that are after, well, like the corn borer, it's called the corn borer because it goes after corn, doesn't go after other stuff. So maybe if all you've got is corn, all you're going to hurt are the corn borers. Through genetic engineering, scientists have been able to take the gene for the protein that's produced by this bacterium that's harmful to moths and butterflies and insert it into corn. And something between 20 and 25% of all the acreage of corn in this country today contains the BT gene. So what are the consequences for monarch butterflies, for example? Well, monarch butterflies are very selective in what they eat. They eat milkweed. They don't eat anything else, except by accident. And what are the chances of an accident occurring? Well, in some cornfields, you will find milkweed growing in the field. And if you've got it surrounded by BT corn, pollen from the corn tassels, the tassels actually are the female, pollen from the corn stamens could land on the milkweed plant, and you could have the caterpillars of the monarch butterfly eating the pollen, and maybe enough to be lethal, if they happen to be breeding at the same time that the corn plant is producing the pollen. In fact, there's a relatively short period of time when that pollen is produced by the corn plant, whereas the monarch butterflies generally have several generations in succession. They have staggered generations. So you might have the monarch butterfly breeding all through the corn growing season, but there's that short period of time when there's this BT pollen that might fall on the milkweed, either in the cornfield or adjacent to it. Now, pollen from corn doesn't travel far, but it travels far enough. Corn is wind pollinated. It's not pollinated by insects. And so the pollen is light enough to be carried at least some distance. So it's a real concern. It's a concern that has been studied by scientists and was before BT corn was approved for release into the environment. But this article in Orion points to some problems with the process. One problem is that these companies produce their own studies. That is, Monsanto or Pioneer Seed are the ones that actually hire the scientists to do the studies. This is not unusual in this country's regulatory framework. Pharmaceutical companies do the same thing. The drugs that you take, your prescription drugs, for the most part, are not studied in independent government laboratories. They are studied by independent laboratories that are under contract to the pharmaceutical companies. Now, the scientists in these companies presumably have some integrity. Their work is scrutinized from the outside. And they don't fake their results in order to please their source of revenue. We have to have some confidence in that system. And we don't find a lot of people dropping dead from taking their drug prescriptions. But it does raise concern. And if we're going to set up another mechanism, then we need a much, much bigger National Institutes of Health or Food and Drug Administration running laboratories. And we have to have confidence that the government is going to do a better job than this private mechanism that now exists. So.
David,
yes?
Companies could give the money to the government and the government give it out to the labs. It seems like there's a really potential conflict of interest when you might know that the corn people, you can see all this funding down the line, and you know if you get certain results, you're going to have a lot more funding for your lab, and mm-hmm. if you're going to report some concerns, you're not going to get funding, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. there's been a number of cases. There were some news people recently that were fired from their job because they wouldn't do a report. It was something to do with Monsanto, and they knew that the results weren't right, and they were fired from the job. And they knew, I mean, I guess we could say if they didn't, they knew if they just go ahead and do the report as it was written by Monsanto, they would keep their job. I think it could get a tricky thing, even though the scientist wasn't thinking about doing that. He might have seen some concerns and think, well, mention them, and they were saying, well, that's not enough to really worry about, and just keep quiet about that if you want more funding. Slippery slope, I think. Right?
Yeah.
I guess I just have a question about the specifics of the bacillus.
Thuringiensis. Just BT.
BT. When it was, I guess I don't understand the difference. When it was put on the corn as to keep the moths and things away.
Yeah.
It still would have gotten on the milkweed or whatever.
That's right.
Right. So
yeah.
The effects of doing it, putting it manually on the corn and injecting it into the corn are basically the same. Is that correct?
Well, there's a difference in that it's always there in the corn. So the corn plant is toxic all the time for anything that eats it. Okay. Whereas if it's dusted, it's gonna wash off eventually. Also, the BT gene is going to be in the corn that you eat, and it's going to produce that protein, which breaks down in the acidity of our stomachs. So it does us no harm. But there is a difference in, you know, for an organic farmer that's dusting with BT but wouldn't hear of using genetically engineered corn, they can say, well, yeah, we use it discreetly, but then you can wash it off and there will be no trace of it on the food that you eat.
But then wouldn't it, when you're washing it off, like you were saying, like just a little bit of it is released at a certain time when the corn is pollinating or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you're dusting it on a bunch of times, isn't it more in the air even, and have even more of a chance of getting on the milkweed, which is like the plant that the monarch butterfly eats? I mean,
it could be.
I'm just curious about that.
No. Well, it's a valid point, and I would say that the folks who are not that shook up about BT corn would recognize that that's one way where it might be an advantage. Yes?
Yeah, I think she's right that if somebody dusts a field with BT instead of using the genetically altered corn, it's still going to be bad news for the butterflies.
Right.
But people can always plant a field of milkweed for the butterflies and get away from either of those problems if you care about butterflies. But the other thing is that you won't be spraying those fields with stuff that's very bad for you,
mm-hmm.
which are insecticides that are sprayed on airplanes.
Right.
So for humans, it may be a real big net gain unless you happen to be allergic to that one protein.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one possible drawback.
Yeah.
Won't there always be a search for the perfect thing, though? I mean, we're never going to buy food product or a substance that someone's not allergic to.
Mm-hmm.
too many different allergens.
Yeah. Well, I would guess we're always going to have people allergic to things, and sure. You know, unless we turn ourselves into some kind of monoculture. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could talk a bit more about the issues involved and implications of genetically modification or whatever. You know, you hear of tomatoes with fish genes in it, or
right, yeah.
Salmon with some other genes.
Right. Yeah, they can take genes that produce phosphorescence in marine organisms and put them into plants so that the plant. dark. You know, which is a stunt that has been done, because it's an easy way of verifying that you've actually had a successful transgenic cross.
And then you can see the tomatoes in the dark.
Right. Yeah. You know,
so many important purposes.
Well, you know, for example, you wouldn't have to have that light in the refrigerator
That's
anymore.
Right.
Well, isn't that the kind of thing that gives the genetic engineering such a bad name? Is these things that are stunts, and it appears to be hubristic? Or
well, they're not. You know, people would lose their funding if they spend tens of thousands of dollars just on stunts, because the National Academy of Sciences doesn't have that much of a sense of humor when they evaluate grant applications. So it's the reason for it was that it is a way of readily identifying that a certain gene is present, and they don't have to run electrophoretic gels. You know, that's the stuff that separates out the DNA. You know those bands of you saw on the O.J. Simpson trial. That comes from running. You use enzymes to break up DNA into little pieces, and the pieces are longer or shorter depending on their molecular weight. You put an electric current through this gelatin, and then you race them, and you see who gets farther down, and that determines. You know, it's according to how long the string is, and how long the string is depends on where they got cut by the enzyme that was specific to a particular gene sequence. And that's why, you know, you see those barcodes. It's because they race the little snippets of DNA after cutting them up with enzymes, and if you've got identical DNA, you're going to get an identical barcode. But that's an expensive process to run that race. And if you've got something that glows in the dark, you don't have to. You say, there it is. But it's a good question. The transgenic stuff, that's what really people think of as Frankenfood or the Frankenforest, and gives people the you're introducing a gene from one organism that could not possibly find its way into that organism in nature. Yes, you have something on that?
On his thing about the fish and the tomatoes, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, sure. Please.
There are fish that live near the Arctic, and they live in such cold conditions that they should freeze solid, and they don't. And the reason they don't freeze solid is because God has developed a way to keep them from freezing solid, and by a certain protein, which they call the antifreeze protein, which allows things to go below what normally would be freezing temperatures and not freeze solid. So people said, oh, is there a way of keeping tomatoes from freezing with a quick freeze overnight? And one way was, they said, well, God's already invented an antifreeze protein, let's just have the tomatoes make it. So that sounds like quite a switch to go from a fish to the other, but it's the only antifreeze protein that God ever invented that we know of. And they put it in. And it keeps the tomatoes from, they can still grow longer into the growing season when they're getting snap freezes at night. But as far as your diet is concerned, it's probably as unusual as saying that if you're an Eskimo, you shouldn't put a tomato on your codfish sandwich. Because it's an unnatural mixture. But so it may actually be utilizing what God has already provided us in a very strange way, but it's not something, because no one has ever invented a way to come up with an antifreeze protein. Mm-hmm. That's something that came from nature. And it is something that would never have happened without genetic engineering, but it may not be any stranger than that. It sounds bizarre, but in fact, that's what it is.
Yeah. There's a question. Should we ever do a transgenic organism? Can Can it ever be a good thing? Do we want to cross that threshold? And I'll give you the best example I know of for posing the question. That is, most of the insulin produced in this country today is produced by a transgenic bacterium. A gene for making the insulin protein was inserted through engineering, genetic engineering techniques into a bacterium that now pumps it out in great quantity, much more cheaply, and much more simply, much more reliably, safely, and purely than the previous methods of extracting insulin.
And it's human insulin.
It's what?
It's human insulin.
Right, right. It is human insulin. Yeah, we're not getting it from animals, which is what we used to do. So, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? If it were your child, would you use that insulin? Would you insist on the non-human, animal-derived insulin? Or would you accept that this transgenic engineering actually can be a good thing sometimes? And if it can be a good thing in that case, what do you use as the basis for drawing the line?
You monopolize the world with a monoculture. You get all of this one type of corn, you spread it all over the Midwest, and we still really don't know the effects, not just on monarch butterflies, but pollinators, which pollinate all types of flowers. And I think that's where the real fear is. I mean, individually, I think it's a great scientific advancement, but you just take it and you wipe out the diversity unknowingly in many cases, unknowingly in other cases, and we don't know as the web unravels.
Mm-hmm. Well, and go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, like, I don't know that many specific cases at all. Like, I don't know much about the subject at all. And in the insulin case, it seems like it's based a lot in need and what people need. And one of my concerns with all of it, all of the genetic engineering with plants and stuff, is that, and maybe I'm wrong, so somebody needs to correct me, but it seems like it's based on a belief that we don't have enough of the food that we need here on Earth right now. And that, you know, there's people going hungry if only we could genetically modify certain beans so that it can give more protein to people in Africa. When really maybe what needs to happen is that we need to stop over-consuming and we need to share more of the world's resources. And so part of me wonders if the reason that we do it is to find ways around the more difficult solutions to those problems. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. It makes a lot of sense. I just read yesterday an essay by Wendell Berry about agricultural technology, which said nothing about transgenic organisms or genetic engineering. He was talking about agribusiness as it has developed in this country today and how it was not sustainable and how actually he said that it was a big mistake to start relying on large-scale mechanized agriculture using fossil fuels. He said that back when we used mules and horses and oxen, we had solar energy growing the crops to feed the animals, and we had family farms, and we had lots of skilled farmers who were producing food organically, and it all changed after World War II. And he said that was a big mistake. So I think it's not so much an issue of transgenic organisms that transformed American agriculture or that threatened to, this is laid on top of a highly integrated, highly developed sector of our economy that exists whether or not we have transgenic organisms. And it may be that transgenic organisms would or could in some way help to reinforce that existing system, but they're not creating something that didn't already exist.
Like the tomato example. people there. I mean, it's purely out of economic convenience for the growers that want to have their tomato that is not going to get wiped out, and for us consumers that must have our tomatoes in January, whatever.
Well, when
I think that there are some real horrible examples, like the cotton, where they put something in to make cotton not die if you spray Roundup on it. You know what Roundup is? It just kills any weed or any living thing almost.
Any plant.
Cotton that can do it. And so now the cotton can grow in it, and you can kill all the weeds in the field by spraying Roundup on it. But then you're spraying tons of Roundup on people and everybody around those fields. That's a horrible example because it increases spraying poisons. But in the case of the corn, it should really cut down how much poison is being sprayed around. So there are good and bad examples even within the stuff that's economically useful. And I think that one, which means now we can spray Roundup all over the place, that's a horrible example.
Yeah, well, actually...
my in-laws used to live right at the end of a cotton field, and the planes would spray right across their housetop, and they'd have to stay inside, and it would, you know... To increase that on people is not a good idea at all.
Yeah, well,
I wasn't arguing that all of this stuff is good, but there's some examples that may actually cut down how much of that stuff goes on.
Yeah, being a plant biologist who is familiar with herbicides, both their action and their persistence in the environment, I have to say Roundup is probably one of the most benign herbicides in use. You know, you can buy Roundup at any grocery store, hardware store. It's got the lowest level of, there's always a hazardous materials information sheet that comes with these things. The half-life of Roundup in the soil is quite short. It's just a matter of days before it's broken down by the organisms in the soil. Also, Roundup is very close to a natural plant hormone known as auxin, which stimulates growth in plants. If plants have too much auxin, they will bolt. Cabbage, for example, if you give it auxin, instead of staying in a nice head, it'll go zoop. So Roundup can replace a lot of things, a lot of herbicides like 2,4-D, and other things that might have either dioxin precursors or some trace of dioxin in them. Roundup has none of that, and it doesn't persist in the soil, and it comes in contact with a leaf, but then it's translocated into the roots of the plant and it kills it systemically. And so there actually could be an advantage to using Roundup Ready crops, because you could use something that is going to wipe all of the other things out without having to use, say, a broadleaf herbicide that might be more toxic, or if you've got a if you're growing a broadleaf plant, you use a grass-specific herbicide that might be more toxic. So, you know, it's a balance. And you have to find the right one.
About Roundup too, and our county extension people and said no problem with Roundup, but then a group that's promoting no spray along our county roads, and I guess I should ask what the articles were, but mm-hmm. Does Monsanto make Roundup?
Yep, they sure do.
And so my sense of what this person was telling me was that all those tests that Roundup is safe and breaks down were done by Monsanto, which you're saying is probably how all these tests are done anyway, and that there's some other studies that have just come out. There was some court case recently that shows that it really doesn't, and it's not as safe as people have been saying. So are you familiar with any of this information?
No, I haven't heard that.
She was saying there was just a case that was settled in April, and it was showing that Roundup isn't this benign thing that just breaks down in a few days and there's no problems at all. But I should get more information, because I don't know the references, you know.
Right, yeah. Well, we all need more information.
Yeah, so anyway, but I've always heard people say this, but just keep on the lookout for that, because it might be an interesting thing for you too, and I'll try to figure out what it
would be. In general, I think that What we have to bear in mind is that there are consequences for the environment with current agricultural practices, leaving aside genetic engineering. You know, the way things are done now, lots of use of chemicals. Ammonium phosphate is poured out onto these fields. The nitrates then leach out of the soil and get into the groundwater, into surface water. They get into areas, into lakes and ponds. They promote the bloom of all kinds of algae that produces toxins, bacteria that produce toxins. They cause eutrophication, which is the gradual filling in of lakes and ponds. They've made a mess of the Everglades. All of these things are from current industrial farming techniques. And so there's a lot more that goes into the question of what we do about agriculture than simply the issue of transgenic crops. And I think actually that there is, because people are fearful of them, an exaggerated focus on some of the consequences of the transgenic organisms, rather than looking at the entire issue of how crops are farmed in this country and how that process could be improved. There's an economic impetus behind all of this. Nobody's doing nothing except for money where this is concerned. If you really don't like it, organic produce is available in more and more markets. It's being much more widely used, and there's now an official federal certification for organic crops, and people also have standards in California and Oregon that are widely applied. You pay a premium for organic food. It costs more. It costs more to produce it. The larger the scale on which it's produced, maybe the price goes down a little bit, but by its very nature, organic farming is labor intensive. If you like organic farming, then you like the scale on which it's produced. You'd have to be willing to pay the price for it and patronize stores that produce it and farmers that do.
Bill Boyer just put out, I don't know if anybody saw it, PBS called Earth at the Edge, 2-hour documentary, taking 5 sections of the Earth ecoregions and discussing sustainability. And essentially, the gist of it is that we are destroying the fabric that supports humanity, let alone the rest of nature. Mm-hmm. And that there are things that we can't do, and one of them is recognize some of these. I mean, mining of the oceans through overfishing, all of this big scale is really very detrimental.
Yeah. Do you want to say
that's
something?
Along the lines a little bit of what I was thinking is that the problem is in reality is consumption and our demand for really more than what we need. Where I grew up in Montana, as a young person, we were lucky to get 20 to 30 bushel to the acre in the soil that we were farming. That same soil now produces 80 to 120 bushel to the acre because of the injection of ammonium phosphates into the soil. And it is destroying the watersheds within the area. And it all comes back to consumption. We, and myself included, are demanding so much for our own personal gratification that we're promoting an industry that thrives on this issue of supporting an accelerated growth of things. And that, to me, is where the misguided direction is. Unfortunately, there are individuals who keep looking at the genetic engineering as the problem. And in reality, it's not the genetic engineering, it's us who are the consumers. And it's those people themselves who are fighting this genetic engineering that need to refocus their direction on, we need to change our lifestyles. And unfortunately, I don't see that happening. I have a very pessimistic view of where we're going unless people are willing to give up all of these pleasures that we have in terms of watching television, We got our kids going to schools and using computer systems that are so sophisticated that it keeps continually in reinforcing this concept of things and consumption. And somewhere along the line, that's what's got to change.
Or to make the chemical companies responsible for, you know, the pollution. Don't you think that you're not, maybe you'd say, gee, you know, I was producing 20 bushels per acre, now I'm producing 80. This is great, but you're not taking in the full life, you know, cycle analysis that, okay, you know, now you're going to have to truck in all your water from someplace else because...
It's the issue of greed, and we as consumers continually sustain that. We demand all of these things, and people who, the Monsanto people, realize this, and they understand this is the way they can survive financially, is to support that consumption process.
Yeah, what we have is a problem of what economists call externalities. It's almost lunchtime. Externalities are costs of a process or an economic transaction that are not accounted for by the transaction. For example, when you drive your car, it emits pollution. But nobody's paying for that, except that we're all paying for it in declining health, in less aesthetic appeal, in damage to the plant and animal life. The way to internalize the externalities would be to put a tax on pollution. You know, depending on the level of emissions, the number of miles you drive, the miles per gallon that your machine gets, you could pay a tax that's proportionate to that. We have ways of figuring that out nowadays. How many people are going to vote in favor of that? You know, and you can do the same thing with the application of nitrogen fertilizers. You know, you could figure out, all right, how much is this going to contribute to excess runoff in our soils and groundwater, and put a tax on it. You know, you go to the store to buy a bag of fertilizer, it's got a pollution tax on it. You make the tax high enough, it's going to cut back on the use enough so that only the people that it's really going to be worth something to are going to use it, and they're going to be very careful not to use more than they absolutely have to. But short of that, and that's a market mechanism for doing it, the other thing you can do is just make a rule and have cops to enforce it. Mm-hmm. Cops of one kind or another, people going around with, you know, some enforcement powers. So there are different ways it can be done, but the will...
Well, I think like in Washington a year or two ago, I think we passed a law that on fertilizers that forbid, you know, certain levels of different toxic stuff in the fertilizer. Nobody even realized all this stuff was in the fertilizer until the Times did a kind of an expose.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think people, when they're buying it, even thought, I mean, they just assumed that it wasn't going to put any toxic metals on their stuff.
Right, yeah, they never imagined. Yeah, Daryl?
There is one difference with the genetic engineering, and that's that you get a patent for process, which takes it out of the public realm into the private realm and makes it really a very different process. In terms of giving people choices about it, I think that's a dramatic difference with, you know, natural selectivity in terms of plant development.
Yeah, that's true. This question of owning a genetic sequence or an organism that has a particular genome, it becomes intellectual property with trademark and patent rights. It does give the owners of those patents more power until somebody comes in with a competing organism. I better shut up, or we're going to miss lunch.
Can I say one thing about the cynic's view? Is so you walk in the supermarket and you see a carrot. How do you really know that that's organically grown? Just as you, how do you know that the bottle of water that you pay a buck for is really any different from the tap water?
Yeah, well, you just have to...
Go on faith, I guess.
Well, you go on faith, but you also, in part, you're trusting the competitors of that, the carrot seller, to expose
There's some certification.
They're misfeasance. Yeah, there is a certification process, but of course you're trusting the merchants, the producers, everybody up and down the line, as you do with all kinds of things. You know, you're trusting your car has an engine in it that's well built. But
there's always room for a city.
You bet.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Great job.